It's Friday, April 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a majority of the offshore finances recently uncovered trace back to China.
It's such a hot issue across Vietnam that no politician can do anything other than say they're going to defend Vietnamese sovereignty.
Vietnam has new top leadership. Also ahead, are you wearing larger clothes than before? Well, you're not alone. A groundbreaking talent program is about to sign off. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. A massive data leak from a Panamanian firm has revealed that, from relatives of the founding father of the People's Republic of China, Mao Zedong, to current leader Xi Jinping, offshore holdings are commonplace among the families of China's ruling elite. Among the more than 11 million documents are details about the offshore holdings of relatives of at least seven current and former Politburo Standing Committee members, a powerful political body in China, and also the grandson-in-law of Mao Zedong. We begin to understand this large magnitude with VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide.
This ton of documents that has been leaked really touches on almost all the eras of Chinese leadership. I mean, even Hu Yaobang, who was premier in the 80s, his son was also among those who information was provided about his offshore holdings. And so it really seems like almost no one is untouched. And really, you know, that's long been the situation, and the public here knows that high-ranking officials, there's a lot of abuse and corruption, and that's why Xi Jinping has been waging this huge anti-corruption campaign. But the problem is that, and as we see from these revelations, is that there are still many ways to get around things, to hide your money, and you can still get away with it. And, you know, it could be those who are currently in power. I mean, we have three current Standing Politburo Committee members, this top political body in China, that are listed among those, the family members of those who are listed in these documents that are revealed. So it really shows just how prevalent the problem is.
On Wednesday, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists said that Chinese leaders' relatives who have offshore holdings include Deng Zhigui, the brother-in-law of President Xi Jinping. The ICIJ also said its analysis of leaked records indicates that by the end of 2015, Mossack Fonseca, the law firm at the center of this document dump, was collecting fees for more than 16,300 offshore companies from China and Hong Kong. That accounted for 29% of its business worldwide. Hong Kong is the company's busiest office in Asia and the world, which no doubt is affecting the outlook of most Chinese residents.
With a slowing economy, with concern about jobs, and seeing how the party has, or those, the family members of those in the party leadership have benefited, apparently, from their position. Obviously, we don't have any clear connections between wrongdoing yet that have emerged from the leakage of the documents. The only ones that really kind of seem that there's a direct connection between corruption are the documents that are related to Gu Kailai, the wife of Bo Xilai, and both of them are in prison now. So it really, and that's probably why officials are cracking down so hard and trying to control the flow of this information. And China has been waging this campaign against corruption, but it's always been at their own pace and in a very controlled manner. You mentioned earlier about, you know, the New York Times and Bloomberg, how they have written these big exposés about the financial holdings and the investments of the family members of high-ranking Communist Party leaders. And we've seen what's happened in those cases. Their websites have been blocked. Journalists working for those organizations have been refused visas.
And you can be sure to follow the latest developments on the Panama Papers at our website. It's still up, voanews.com. Our thanks to Bill Ide in Beijing. We turn now to our social media segment and politics here in the United States. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in Studio 22 to tell us what's trending online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
The U.S. presidential race is turning up the heat on the Democratic side as well as the Republican side.
Absolutely. And let's be honest, it's been turning up for a while on the GOP side, spearheaded by billionaire businessman Donald Trump. But the escalation in rhetoric is somewhat new between the two Democratic contenders.
What's the latest?
It's about who is more qualified to lead the country. Clinton started the conversation after losing Tuesday's Wisconsin primary, and she raised questions about Sanders' qualifications, and here is her quote verbatim. "Like a lot of people, I am concerned that some of his ideas just won't work because the numbers don't add up. In a number of important areas, he doesn't have a plan at all."
I'm sure Sanders retorted.
He did. He said, "She has attacked me for being unqualified, and if I'm attacked for being unqualified, I will respond in kind." And here's his quote-unquote attack. "People might wonder about your qualifications when you supported virtually every trade agreements which have cost the American worker millions of decent-paying jobs."
Well, jobs is a big issue among voters. What's the online reaction like?
Well, mainstream media outlets like CNN and NBC News have posted on Facebook, and here's an example of the caption. CNN wrote, "Bernie Sanders' comments mark an escalation in rhetoric between the Vermont senator and Hillary Clinton." Many of the replies argued CNN is ignoring Sanders prefacing his statement and that he's simply defending himself. In related news, Clinton supporters started a new hashtag, #HillarySoQualified. Now, unfortunately for the former secretary, that hashtag has backfired. Many on the Twitter are using the hashtag ironically, criticizing her for voting in favor of the Iraq War and her Wall Street speeches. Jim?
Well, the intrigue continues. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. G tweets for our program's account at @VOA_IE. She also has her very own @GAbbyLee. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Vietnam has completed a change in its top leadership with the approval of 62-year-old Nguyen Xuân Phúc as Prime Minister by the National Assembly.
Thưa Quốc hội, tôi xin trân trọng cảm ơn Quốc hội đã tín nhiệm.
He thanked the Assembly for their vote of confidence and swore absolute loyalty to the country, the people, and the Constitution, and he vowed to continue with economic reforms and to combat corruption. Completing Vietnam's political leadership, Communist Party leader Nguyen Phu Tro was re-elected in January as Secretary General. On Saturday, Tran Dai Quang was approved as president. They face soaring public debt, a budget deficit, and China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea. Vietnam analyst, Professor Emeritus, and consultant Carl Thayer told VOA's Victor Beatty that the new prime minister hails from central Vietnam, and he spent his adult life rising through the ranks of the communist hierarchy.
Most of his career until about 2011, well, in fact, all of it, except for some study, was based in provincial administration, rising up through the ranks of both the party and the local government there. And then in 2011, he got elected to the Central Committee, was put in charge of the government office, in other words, the person who ran the business of cabinet for the prime minister, then was made one of the deputy prime ministers. And then when the 12th Party Congress that met in January decided to retire the current prime minister of Vietnam, Nguyen Xuân Phúc was chosen to succeed him.
He, in a speech, vowed to continue with reform, fight corruption, and defend the country's sovereignty. Is that about what you expected?
Yes, I think, in fact, that's the pattern when they just elected the president of the country. He said the same thing about sovereignty. That's a key issue. The retiring prime minister had gone out in the front on that, and it was sometimes seen that he was more advanced. But it's such a hot issue across Vietnam that no politician can do anything other than say they're going to defend Vietnamese sovereignty.
Well, Vietnam now has a new triumvirate at the head of government. What direction, if any, change might occur in Vietnam?
Well, for the most part, the very broad economic policies have been set. They released a five-year socioeconomic plan that's a product of interagency action, and it's to meet the issue of public debt, unperforming loans issued by state banks to the state-owned enterprises. That's key, controlling inflation, getting a growth rate around just over 6.5% or 6.7%, and at the end of this five-year period, creating a middle-income country from Vietnam. That's set. Foreign policy, likewise, Vietnam is not going to veer in a line with any one country. It tries to maintain a multipolar balance. That's a difficult act because as they have these problems with China that you've alluded to, they've just put at least four or five bloggers in jail, imprisoned them after very brief trials, which is not going to endear them to the United States, especially since President Obama is due there in May.
Carl Thayer says given his relative junior status, he doesn't expect the new prime minister to engage in any new initiatives for at least the first 2 years of his five-year term. He says the communist-ruled country has evolved in recent years, adopting a constitution in 1992 and requiring all constituencies to have multiple candidates run for office. Thayer says independent candidates are expected to test the government's commitment to reform by seeking candidacies in what is normally a tightly controlled process in National Assembly elections next month, at about the same time that President Obama arrives in the country for a state visit. If it appears to you that people seem to be getting larger, well, you may be right. The rate of obesity worldwide is expanding at a rate where, in just a few years, overweight people will make up a majority of the population. Newsweek health reporter Jessica Ferger has looked into a new report indicating that trend. Jessica, what's the definition of obesity?
BMI, which is body mass index, it's a measurement that is used to measure the amount of fat on your body. A BMI of 25 to 29 meets the criteria for somebody who's overweight, and then from 30 to 39, it's considered obese. So essentially, one really should try to keep their BMI below 25 in order to maintain a healthy weight and overall health.
It appears that people who have high BMIs are growing rapidly by numbers.
Right. There was a study that came out in the journal The Lancet earlier this week. It was quite extensive. It's probably one of the largest studies that have been done on the subject. But it looked at 1,698 population-based studies, which accounted for 186 countries worldwide, which is not, you know, making up 99% of the population. And it found that by 2025, a fifth of the world's population is expected to meet the criteria for obesity. So that's a huge shift from what we've seen in previous decades, where there was a much higher rate of being underweight. There was low body weight problem.
And what parts of the world does this seem to be affecting the most? I suspect Western nations are in that mix.
The UK and the US seems to be leading this trend. In the US, by 2025, 43% of men and women are expected to be obese. And then in the UK, that's 40% of adults. So that's really alarming. But then there have been some other surprising findings from the study. For example, in the island nations of Polynesia and Micronesia, the body mass index is significantly high. On average, it's almost 35 for women and around 32 for men. So that's concerning. But there are a lot of nations in the world that are still really struggling with poverty, of course, and that and you know, food scarcity. And that means that, you know, there's a big problem still with low body weight, which creates all kinds of other significant health problems. In particular, it's very problematic for pregnant women and newborns, and can also make it more difficult to fight off certain infections such as tuberculosis. And, you know, there's also been a lot of research that, you know, within the genetics, there are certain foods that can be especially damaging to health in certain populations. You know, we've seen things where as a Western diet of processed food starts to make its way throughout the world, you're seeing a pretty big spread of obesity because of the way that these certain foods that we're consuming act in the body.
Jessica Ferger is Newsweek's health reporter. Check out her article online. Obese could soon outnumber underweight populations worldwide. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
As the saying goes, all good things must come to an end. After 14 seasons and launching the careers of such pop stars as Kelly Clarkson, Carrie Underwood, and Jennifer Hudson, American Idol is going off the air. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the show and its legacy.
The producers of American Idol are keenly aware that the landscape is changing a bit, that that particular arena, that sort of like talent contest reality show arena is crowded. And I think also it's about saying we were the first, we were the best, and maybe we need to get out of this before it, there's a term called jumps the shark, meaning it's just, it's getting to the point where now people are getting tired of it. It's no longer good. It's going to lose its reputation, the glory. So let's just kind of jump off the ship before it sinks, if you will.
And it was the prototype for several programs. I mean, Simon Cowell, the original producer of what was called Pop Idol in Britain, brought it to America, and he did American Idol for several seasons. Then he left and went and did The X Factor, which is another singing judging show. You've also got America's Got Talent, which has got a panel of judges. You've got The Voice. Then you've got Dancing with the Stars, So You Think You Can Dance. It's all, it's the same show, basically, with different, slightly different content.
It is. And what's really interesting is before American Idol, when you thought about reality show, so you thought about Survivor or The Real World, the I don't know if Amazing Race was out at that time, but this was the first time when I think Americans here, and I'm sure this was also the case overseas, felt like they could participate. They had a vested interest in what was going on because they got to choose the winner. As before, we were just sort of observing what was going on in reality. This time, as viewers, we were participating in creating a certain reality. And that was very exciting. And I read somewhere, interestingly enough, that American Idol was largely responsible for the increased usage of text messaging, because when they first started to introduce text messaging in the voting process, many people weren't using it. And Ryan Seacrest literally had to spend like 4 minutes during the show explaining to people how to text message.
That was also when texts cost you money.
That's when they cost you money, absolutely. And now you don't even text. Now you can go online and you can vote online. There's so many different ways, via Facebook, Twitter.
They have an app.
Some of these shows
have an app, and they actually have the performer's face, and it's like, you know, vote for this person, and you touch the face, and boom, your vote has been registered. Thank you.
Right. So interesting to see how the show and technology have grown together.
So what do you think the legacy of American Idol is going to be?
Well, I think the one thing that we will walk away with is, as I said earlier, it changed the way Americans interacted with television. I think that was probably the biggest thing. It is the first show that I remember being fully interactive in the way that it is. And I think, too, I mean, Kelly Clarkson, Carrie Underwood, Jennifer Hudson. I mean, these are huge names when we talk about American popular culture. American Idol was responsible for introducing the country to, and the world, really, to our favorite pop stars and country music stars and R&B stars. That's the other thing that I loved about American Idol. Though there was some controversy for a few years, they were the artists that won across various genres.
So are you an American Idol fan? Who is your favorite winner? What do you think about it going away? Well, you can hit Shauna up on Twitter. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. And you can hear Shauna's show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
There's a visual to think about. Ryan Seacrest spending 4 minutes telling people how to text message. I think they ought to put that on YouTube or somewhere as a legacy video. Well, our text messaging and our show, it's all over now. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter, at VOA underscore IE. But don't worry, even though it's finished for now, we'll be back again. Thanks for joining us. Come back when you can. Our director's Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the conclusion of the recent nuclear security summit in Washington, President Barack Obama pointed to the nuclear deal agreed to by Iran, the European Union, and the P5 plus one countries, the JCPOA, as one of the top accomplishments in his administration's drive to halt the spread of nuclear weapons. Regarding the JCPOA, Mr. Obama said his first priority had been to make sure that Iran's nuclear weapons program was stopped and that material that would have given Iran a very short breakout capacity was shipped out of the country. That has happened, he said. President Obama noted that so far, Iran's leaders have lived up to the JCPOA to the letter.
They have, in fact, based on the presentations that were made by the IAEA this morning to the P5 plus one, followed the implementation steps that were laid out. And as a consequence, sanctions related to their nuclear program have been brought down.
Mr. Obama said that Iran does face a challenge in getting businesses to feel comfortable that the JCPOA is holding and that there are no longer risks due to nuclear sanctions if companies do business with Iran. President Obama pledged to address some of the concerns Iran has expressed over this issue. But President Obama cautioned that the spirit of the JCPOA involves Iran also sending signals to the world community and businesses that it is not going to be engaging in a range of provocative actions that might scare business off.
When they launch ballistic missiles with slogans calling for the destruction of Israel, that makes businesses nervous. If Iran continues to ship missiles to Hezbollah, that gets businesses nervous.
President Obama said that the United States has a responsibility to provide clarity about the rules that govern so that the Iranian people can benefit from an improved economic situation. But, Mr. Obama stressed, Iran has to understand what every country in the world understands, which is businesses want to go where they feel safe, where they don't see massive controversy, where they can be confident that transactions are going to operate normally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Thank you.